Our second reading, we will begin a new book here, 1 Samuel chapter 1. The first book of Samuel, otherwise called the first book of the Kings, chapter 1, verse 1. Hear now the inerrant, infallible, and inspired word of God. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim, of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephrathite. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, Hannah had no children. And this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. And when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and daughters portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah. But the Lord had shut up her womb. And her adversary also provoked her sore, for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why weepest thou? And why eatest thou not? And why is thy heart grieved? Am I not better to thee than 10 sons? So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul, and prayed unto the Lord, and wept sore. And she vowed a vow, and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid, and remember me, and forget not thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. And it came to pass, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she had been drunken. And Eli said unto her, How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee. And Hannah answered and said, No, my lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. And they rose up in the morning early and worshipped before the Lord, and returned and came to their house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. Wherefore it came to pass, when the time was come about after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son, and called his name Samuel, saying, Because I have asked him of the Lord. And the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer unto the Lord the yearly sacrifice and his vow, but Hannah went not up. For she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned, and then I will bring him that he may appear before the Lord and there abide forever. And Elkanah, her husband, said unto her, Do what seemeth thee good. Tarry until thou have weaned him. Only the Lord establish his word. So the woman abode and gave her son suck until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with three bullocks and one ephah of flour and a bottle of wine, and brought him unto the house of the Lord in Shiloh, and the child was young. And they slew a bullock, and brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here, praying unto the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord. And he worshipped the Lord there. May God add his blessing to the reading and to the hearing of his most holy word. All right, so who's the author of the book? Well, we think that Samuel is the author of part of it, but there are things written that take place after the death of Samuel, and even though Samuel's death has a very unusual circumstance attached to it, we reckon that Samuel was not the author of the entire book, but that it was written by someone, or finally edited by someone, in the prophetic college that Samuel had founded. The final editing, perhaps as late as 750 BC, long after the division of the kingdom, and there are some markers in the text, some what we call diachronical markers. And by that, that's kind of a technical term. It simply means that there are some terms used that were not used at the time that is described, but is indeed a later term that was edited into the text by some inspired prophet along the way. So the recipients are the Israelites, those of the kingdom, and the purpose is to chronicle the rise of the monarchy, the installation and demise of Saul, and the anointing of David. This is the first book of Samuel. Now, keep in mind that in the Hebrew Bible, we don't have 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. What we have are the four books of the kings. So 1 and 2 Samuel are the first two books of the kings, and then 1 and 2 Kings in the Hebrew Bible are the third and fourth books of the kings. And also keep in mind that this is a running chronology from the beginning to the end of the monarchy, those four books. The beginning to the end of the monarchy in Israel, and the final, the demise of that monarchy in the Babylonian captivity. And so what we have there is of both kingdoms, the northern and the southern kingdom, as we progress into the later books of the kings. But this book here is the rise and installation of David. 2 Samuel then, or the second book of the kings, speaks of the reign of David. And then the last two books of the kings speak of the kings of the northern and the southern kingdoms until the fall of Samaria and then the fall of Jerusalem. Okay, so that's historically how these books work out. The difference between these four books here and the Chronicles are twofold. The first difference is when they were written. 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings are written by contemporary prophets, speaking of the events either, you know, somewhere near the time of their taking place. Almost like the remembrancers, the historians of the day. But these are inspired men. And speaking of the north and the south with regard to both kingdoms. First and Second Chronicles was not finally put together until after the exile, probably by Ezra, as the author of it, or at least its main author, and is the story not of the kingdoms, but the story of the temple itself and how the temple is impacted by the kingdoms themselves. So it's a completely different perspective, written at a completely different time. These four books are more history books. The other two, 1 and 2 Chronicles, we think of them more, and they're the last books of the Hebrew Bible, we think of them as the epilogue upon the nation of Israel and why she came under judgment. We think of several reformations, but how the Lord finally tore down and then rebuilt that temple in the post-exilic days. And so that's what 1 and 2 Chronicles teach us. It's more a history of the worship of the Lord with regard to the southern kingdom. I don't know if you recognize this or not, but in 1 and 2 Chronicles, we don't even talk about the northern kingdom because it has nothing to do with the worship of God. Because from the days of Jeroboam onward, they worshipped in illicit ways in the north. And then in the days of Ahab, children, remember Ahab, we're going to talk about him next week. In the days of Ahab, in the north, we introduced Baal worship through Ahab and Jezebel. Okay? So that's the difference between those books. As a rough outline, we can divide 1 Samuel into three books or three sections. The first section is chapters 1 through 7. And chapters 1 through 7 detail the career and rise of Samuel the prophet and his leadership as the final judge in Israel. Okay? So that's chapters 1 through 7. Then chapters 8 through 15, we have the rise of King Saul and his installation as king, his victories, his early career. And then in 16:1 through the end, chapter 31, we have the rise of David, Saul's demise and decline in his kingdom, and then finally the death of Saul in the final chapter of 1 Samuel. Okay, so that's a rough outline. And there are some sub-points under that, but those are the broad strokes. So divide 1 Samuel into how many portions? Three. Samuel's portion, Saul's portion, and David's portion. That's the shorthand way to remember it. Okay? And it's important that we remember outlines like that with some kind of shorthand that we can call them up quickly. So three portions of 1 Samuel, Samuel, Saul, and David in that order. Thank you. All right. Thank you for those grins. You understand my struggles. It's having so much in and not being able to get it out in any orderly fashion. That's right. All right. At least that's what I like to tell myself. Maybe it doesn't have anything to say at all, and he just stands up here and vamps for a few minutes. It could be that. All right, so the first section then of chapter 1 is verses 1 through 8. Let me say it this way. We don't have a perfect household here, but we have a godly household. Not a perfect household. Sorry, Elkanah has taken two wives. Not a good thing. Not a testimony of righteousness. Always a testimony in Scripture to some sort of weakness. It's not the original design of God. We find that out from the beginning to the end of the Old Testament. So there are two wives in the household. However, in the midst of those two wives, there are some things that are quite commendable. There is love. There is care. There is speaking tenderly one to another. There is a pouring out of the heart to one another. There are those kinds of intimate family relations that are good. There are also some difficulties. There's the rivalry. And from the reading, I think the strong implication is that Hannah would be happy to leave Peninnah alone. Peninnah is never happy to leave Hannah alone. And so she is called her rival, not because Hannah has made herself a rival, but because Peninnah has made herself a rival. And this is what we might say a sinfully natural result of having more than one wife in the home. We have a godly household also in that there is a continual practice of worship. Remember that Elkanah, now some have said, well, you know, we only see him going up one time a year. He should be going up three times. Let's remember how early it is in ancient Israel. Let's also remember that the Ark of God has not yet been set in its place as it was in David. And so this is a testimony that Elkanah goes up once a year, not only with a worship service, but with a vow unto the Lord, that this is a godly household in that way. This speaks much for the household of Elkanah, Hannah, and Peninnah. Notice also that the women travel with him up to Shiloh to worship. That also speaks well of the entirety of the household and Elkanah's command over his household. We should be at this point reminded of the words of Joshua, who said what? As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And so what did Elkanah do? He took those words of Joshua very seriously. And so as for him and his whole house, they went up yearly to Shiloh to worship the Lord. So as we introduce then the family of Elkanah, we have certainly not a perfect family, but we have a family in which there is much to be commended, and there is much that we can take up by way of example, right? Speaking tenderly to one another, having an empathetic heart one toward another, going up to worship at the appointed seasons with one another. There are many, many good things to be seen here in the household of Elkanah. That Hannah is a godly woman speaks also to the godliness of her husband. Not that she couldn't be godly on her own. That's not what I'm saying. It just speaks to a general godliness in the household. And we see Peninnah as the exception to that and not the rule of it. All right, we also have a wife who has not borne children. The Lord has shut up her womb, and so Hannah is in bitterness of soul. Now, we might wonder about that. We might wonder, is this a proper attitude in Hannah? Is it something that she ought to be thinking? Should she be in bitterness of soul because providentially the Lord has denied her children? Well, while some would blame Hannah for this, I would point to her actions surrounding the entirety of the scene here and say, no, although she's in bitterness of soul, it is not a sinful bitterness of soul because of the desires that she has for the child. Notice that the child is not an end to itself for her, right? She's not going to have a child and then, oh, everything will be fixed. That's not what she's thinking. She wants a child for what particular reason? That she may dedicate him to the Lord his whole life. And so, while there is some bitterness of soul here on the part of Hannah, let's not say that it's a sinful bitterness of soul, because the end of that is described to us in a very godly fashion by the prophet here. Okay? So I think that there is some commendability here for Hannah, you know, that her bitterness of soul has to do with that she doesn't have everything that she would to give to the Lord. And then we have a comforting husband dwelling with her with understanding. That's verses 1 through 8. All right, so then in verses 9 through 18, we have the refuge for Hannah. Hannah has a refuge for her bitterness of soul. Again, this is another indication that her sorrow is not an ungodly sorrow, but a godly sorrow. She goes to prayer. She takes advantage, she takes the opportunity of being at Shiloh, near the tabernacle of the Lord. And so at the tabernacle of the Lord, she makes her petition to the Lord. Now she's a little ways away from it. And what do we see Eli doing? Well, we see him sitting. You know, it's just an incidental comment, although scripturally speaking, I'm not sure there are any of those. And so the first time we see Eli, what's he doing? He's sitting. What is the sin that Eli has involved himself in with his sons? Indulgence, laziness. We will learn about Eli that he's a very fat man, that he's sitting, that they take the choicest, the tastiest of the sacrifices, that they demand those, his sons, and it seems that Eli is participant in that. So we have a high priest that even although he's not everything we would want in a high priest, well, we see that he's at least some things that he should be. And so she makes a prayer and a vow to the Lord. And notice that that in the vow that she makes, she says, I will dedicate him to God all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. Ah, we've heard that. We know what that means. In other words, he will be a Nazarite unto God from the day of his birth until the day of his death. This is one of those ways, along with the statements that we'll find later in chapter 7, that we believe that Samuel was, quote unquote, the last judge of Israel. The mistake of Eli, then, we see also in this second portion, his expectation. Well, perhaps this is born out of the indulgent lifestyle that he has, or observing his ungodly sons, or the general apostasy that ensues from ungodly ministers. It's hard to know which one of those, or a conglomeration of all of them. But his first blush is an evil surmising of what he sees Hannah doing, and he says, she must be drunk. Look at the way her lips move. Sad thing, isn't it? She has a bitterness of heart, and she is bringing her complaint to the Lord. Notice that she's doing everything according to the rules of godliness, and he thinks she's drunk. But Hannah's defense is not haughty, not indignant that she was misunderstood. How dare you? But she defers to him as the high priest. She respects his station, and she explains her case. And then Eli, notice his change of mind toward her in that he offers her a blessing instead of rise up from your wine. and then notice her acceptance of Eli's blessing in humility. And so this is a very godly exchange once Eli gets his mind right as to what's taking place. He does his part as a great high priest. He blesses her. He receives her petition. He offers her that blessing that, remember that the first blessing, the first benediction was given to whom? To Aaron, the high priest. And so he stands in the stream of Aaron offering a blessing to Hannah. Hannah does not receive his first mistake in an insulting way. She does not rise above her station and begin to accuse Eli. She simply makes her case humbly, respecting his authority in the church, and then she receives his blessing in the same way. So it's a very godly exchange between the two of them. All right, so then in verses 19 through the end of chapter 1 through verse 28, they rose up early in the morning and worshipped before the Lord and returned and came to their house to Ramah, and Elkanah knew his wife and the Lord remembered her. Notice it says that they rose up in the morning early. Yep, that's right, Pastor. I was going to say it again. When we talk about rising early, we talk about getting after our business, getting after the duties that God has given to us, getting after our responsibilities, and taking them up with vigor, with thankfulness, with excellence. All of that is encapsulated here when it says that they rose up early and worshiped before the Lord and returned. Rising up early to worship. Novel concept. Standard practice. Fill in the blanks, right? Okay, so the Lord remembered her. That is, it is the Lord who opens and closes the womb. The Lord remembered her petition, and so he gave her a son, and she named him Samuel. Samuel, which means, "Hear, O Lord," or "I have asked him of the Lord," something like that, right? "Hear, O Lord." And notice then, she stayed back to care for her son. This is not unlawful, but note Elkanah's word to her. This is very interesting, and I hope you heard it. I hope, although it passes by as just one brief sentence, listen to it. What does Elkanah say? "Hannah went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned, and then will I bring him that he may appear before the Lord and abide there forever. And Elkanah, her husband, said unto her, Do what seemeth good, tarry until thou have weaned him only. The Lord establish his word." Don't forget the promise you made. Don't forget the vow you vowed. Don't think that by staying home here that you will become so attached to this child that you will not fulfill the vow that you have vowed. The Lord establish his word. Just in one line, her husband lovingly, carefully reminds her of the duty that she had sworn to do. All right, so then, finally, her fulfilling what she had promised, even though it might have been difficult, right? What do we read about in Psalm 14? How is the righteous man characterized in Psalm 14? He vows and keeps even though it's to his hurt, right? And note Eli's response. He worshipped the Lord there, and Samuel worshipped with him. Did you hear that? "Therefore I have lent him to the Lord as long as he liveth. He shall be lent to the Lord," and he worshipped the Lord there. He is Samuel. How old is Samuel here? Just weaned. Now in the ancient Near East, that may mean 3 years old. 2.5, something like that. I don't know. So, you know, his age is not particularly given. We know that she missed at least one season of going up to worship, right? But notice that it was not too early for Samuel to worship the Lord. That's an important point, isn't it? And then the commitment of Hannah, she understands that Samuel is a gift from God, therefore consecrated to him. And I think there is a little bit of an ambiguity here in the King James Version. It may have been perfectly clear to those, you know, 17th century English speakers. But when it says, "As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord, therefore I have lent him to the Lord." The word "lent" there, we get the impression then that Hannah is the owner of the child and she has lent him to the Lord like that, right? Like the Lord could borrow Samuel. Well, that would be a mistake. That's not what the language supports. The language supports, I have asked for him from the Lord, and because the Lord has given him upon my asking, he's not mine, but the Lord's. He's consecrated to the Lord. That's really what the term means that she uses there. And so he belongs to the Lord. Of course, we know that about all of our children. This one especially, because he was dedicated to the service of the Lord before ever he was even born. Right? He was dedicated to the Lord's service as a minister in the Old Testament church. All right, well, this ends the reading then of 1 Samuel chapter 1. Let's look forward to reading through the rest of this book.